On a January morning in 1652, a Greek-born servant named Pasqua Rose opened a small shed in St. Michael's Alley off Cornhill in the city of London and began selling cups of a dark, bitter, very hot drink for a penny. He had learned the trade in Smyrna, in Ottoman Anatolia, where his Levant Company employer had developed the daily habit. The drink was coffee, and Rose's shed is generally taken as London's first coffee house. Within 50 years, there were perhaps 3,000 coffee houses in England. Within 100 years, the institution had a name in every European capital, and around two of its central commodities, chocolate, prepared the Spanish court way with a hand whisk called a molinillo, and tea, served the Chinese way in small porcelain cups, had grown two parallel public rooms. None of these drinks were new. What was new was the architecture European cities began to build around them. This essay is about that architecture, where the drinks actually came from, what European cities did with them in the 17th and 18th centuries, and why the price tag on a modern espresso, a tin of matcha, or a bar of dark chocolate cannot be read honestly without the trade systems and plantation economies that put those drinks into European reach, the cultures that already existed. The story that begins with Pasqua Rose in 1652 is the European chapter, not the first chapter. Coffee, tea, and cacao had each been a structured drink culture for centuries, in some cases more than a millennium, before any European cup was poured. Coffee, the seed of coffee arabica, was being cultivated on terrace slopes in the highlands of Yemen by the 15th century. Sufi orders in Mocha and Aden used the brewed drink to support long nights of prayer. The practice spread through Ottoman religious networks to Mecca, Damascus, and Cairo. The world's first coffee houses, kahvehane, opened in Mecca in the 1510s, then in Cairo, then in Istanbul, where the first documented house dates to 1554, almost exactly a century before Pasqua Rose. By the early 17th century, Istanbul had hundreds of coffee houses with their own architecture, low cushioned benches around the central brazier, chess, music, recitation of poetry, political conversation. Religious authorities periodically tried to close them on the grounds that they competed with the mosque for men's attention. The Ottoman coffee house was the European cafe's direct ancestor, two centuries older, with most of the same social functions already worked out. Tea has the longest pedigree of the three. Camellia sinensis has been cultivated in southwest China for at least 2,000 years. By the Tang Dynasty, 618-907 CE, tea drinking had a ritualized form, described by Lu Yu in his Cha Jing around 760 CE. And by the Song Dynasty, 960-1279, the whisked powder method that Japan would later adopt as matcha was already standard at the Chinese court. Buddhist monks carried both the plant and the practice to Japan during the Heian period. By the late 16th century, Sen no Rikyu had organized the Chanoyu tea ceremony into the philosophical form Japan still teaches today. Each of these was a coherent practice, hundreds of years old, before the Dutch East India Company shipped its first chests of Chinese green tea to Amsterdam in 1610. Cacao is the youngest lineage, but in many ways, the most ceremonial in its origin. Theobroma cacao was domesticated in Mesoamerica at least 3,500 years ago. Olmec, Maya, and later Mexica, Aztec societies, fermented, roasted, ground, and beat the cacao seed into a frothed cold drink mixed with maize, chile, achiote, vanilla, and water. It was bitter. Sugar had no role. It was prized as a ritual offering and a stimulant for rulers. In late post-classic Maya and Mexica economies, cacao beans served as currency. When a Spanish first encountered the drink at the court of Moctezuma II in 1519, it was already an institution with a thousand-year history of preparation technique, ceremonial vocabulary, and economic weight. The Spanish would change almost everything about its texture, temperature, and sweetness. They would not invent it. The European coffee house, tea garden, and chocolate house did not appear in a void. They were the European adaptation of three drink cultures that had been arrived at independently by other civilizations. The thing Europe built was the new public space, not the drink, and not in most cases, the social practice the drink supported. What Europe did contribute was the integration of these three bitter alkaloid drinks into a single commercial and colonial system that had no precedent. The 1640s to 1700s European adoption window. The striking thing about the European adoption of coffee, tea, and chocolate is that it happened for all three in roughly the same 50-year window. Chocolate reached the Spanish court in the 1520s and was widespread in Spanish aristocratic households by the 1580s. By the mid-17th century, it had moved to the French court via the 1615 marriage of Anne of Austria to Louis XIII, then into England. Coffee reached Venice via Ottoman trade by 1615, opened its first European coffee house there in 1645, and was in London by 1652 and Paris by 1672. Café Procope, often cited as the model Paris Café, opened in 1686. Tea reached Amsterdam from the Dutch East India Company's Asian trade by 1610 and went from rare luxury to everyday drink in Britain during the 18th century via the British East India Company's Canton operations. Three different trade systems carried the three drinks. Coffee came through Ottoman intermediaries, Yemeni production, with the port of Mocha as the choke point, then Cairo, then European Mediterranean buyers in Venice and Marseille. The Ottoman state controlled the Mocha trade so tightly that the Dutch had to smuggle live Coffeeyette Arabica seedlings out in 1690 to start their own plantations in Java. That smuggling is the origin of Java as a synonym for coffee. Tea came through the Dutch East India Company, VOC, founded 1602, and that smuggling is the origin of Java as a synonym for coffee. And then the British East India Company, EIC, founded 1600, both buying at Canton and shipping around the Cape of Good Hope. Cacao came through Spanish colonial extraction in Mesoamerica, with the encomienda and later repartimiento labor systems organizing indigenous and African labor on Spanish plantations across what is now Mexico, Guatemala, Venezuela, and Ecuador. The simultaneous arrival is one of the more underread facts in food history. Three drinks, three trade systems, three already sophisticated cultures of origin, all converging on European cities in the same window, and all bitter. What European cities had to build, almost from scratch, was a public forum that could absorb three intensely bitter caffeinated or theobromine-bearing drinks into daily life. The forum they built was the public drinking room organized around bitterness and conversation. That this happened around the same time that printing presses were proliferating, that joint stock companies were inventing themselves as legal persons, that the early newspapers were reaching mass readership, none of this is coincidence. The coffee house was where the news was read aloud. The chocolate house was where the political faction met. The tea garden was where the new urban middle class staged its respectability. The room and the moment found each other. Three different extraction modes. If you want to read coffee, tea, and chocolate as cooking systems rather than as commodities, the cleanest place to start is the physics of how each drink is actually made. The three drinks share an aromatic family, all hot water extractions of plant material whose bitterness comes from alkaloids, caffeine in coffee and tea, both caffeine and theobromine in cacao, and astringent polyphenols. But the extraction methods are entirely different, and each method does different work on the same chemistry. Coffee is a decoction and percolation drink. The roasted bean is ground, hot water is passed through or held in contact with the grounds, and the soluble compounds, caffeine, chlorogenic acid, lipids, melanoidins from the roast, are pulled into the water at a rate set by grind size, temperature, and contact time. The Ottoman method, ground extremely fine, simmered briefly in a small pot called a zezve, and the espresso method, developed in early 20th century Italy, very fine grind, hot water forced through under roughly 9 atmospheres of pressure, are different physical implementations of the same principle. The bitterness comes partly from caffeine, but mostly from chlorogenic acid-derived compounds that develop during roasting. The dark caramel brown color is melanoid in chemistry, the Maillard reaction's gift to the cup. Tea is an infusion drink. The leaf is steeped in hot water without grinding, and the soluble compounds, caffeine, L-theanine, catechins, complex aromatic compounds, diffuse out at a rate set by water temperature, leaf surface area, and time. Tea's bitterness is mostly catechin polyphenols. The astringency comes from the same compounds binding to proteins in the mouth, which is why a cup of strong black tea pulls the tongue. The Japanese matcha preparation is the exception. The leaf is stone ground to a powder and whisked into suspension rather than steeped, but the chemistry is recognizably the same. Chocolate prepared in the early modern European way is a whisking suspension drink. The cacao seed is fermented, roasted, ground at temperature so that the cocoa butter melts and the paste flows, and then beaten into hot water or through the 17th century, increasingly into hot milk, adapted from a Mesoamerican original. The drink is not actually a solution. It is a hot emulsion of cocoa butter, suspended solids, sugar, in the European form, and water held together by lecithin, naturally present in the cacao. The bitterness here is theobromine and a smaller dose of caffeine, plus the cacao's own polyphenols. About 50% of dry cacao mass is cocoa butter, and the fat is what makes the cup feel dense rather than thin. 3 extraction modes, 3 bitter alkaloid profiles, 3 textures in the mouth. European palates had never been educated by 3 such drinks at once. Wine and beer were the prior drinks of the European day. Both fermented, both sweet-leaning, both built on alcohol rather than alkaloids. Hot bitter drinks were not a default category. The chemistry of bitterness, what it does to the tongue, why it pairs the way it does with sugar, why the same caffeine molecule reads differently in 3 different solvents and textures, is the kind of palate education the Atlas of Cooking Systems treats as its own subject in Chapter 1 on Flavor and Seasoning. What the 17th century put on European tables was, in physical terms, a coordinated lesson in bitter chemistry that the rest of European cooking spent the next 200 years catching up to. The new public spaces, a drink that takes 30 seconds to prepare and 10 minutes to consume, creates one kind of social space. A drink that requires a charcoal brazier, a particular pot, a quarter hour of attention, and a suspension of regular activity creates another. The European coffee houses, tea gardens, and chocolate houses of the late 17th and early 18th centuries each took the practical shape of their drink, and each developed a different kind of public function. The coffee house in London, Paris, and Vienna was, before anything else, a newsroom. A penny bought a cup and a seat. Newspapers and pamphlets were laid out on tables. Conversation about politics, finance, and natural philosophy was the room's main product. Pasqua Rosé's London shed was followed by Garraway's, then Edward Lloyd's around 1686 on Tower Street, then Jonathan's, then Will's. Different houses developed different clienteles. Jonathan's in Change Alley became the de facto stock exchange. The men who traded shares in the new joint stock companies met there until the formal London Stock Exchange was institutionalized in 1773. Edward Lloyd's Coffee House, which catered to shipping merchants, evolved into Lloyd's of London, the insurance market still operating in the city today. The Royal Society's natural philosophers met at the Grecian. The Whigs and Tories drank in different houses on principle. The coffee house was a room for men with opinions, money, or both. It was also one of the spaces in which the modern news cycle and the modern financial market took recognizable shape. The tea garden in 18th century London, Vauxhall in its famous renovated form from 1729, Ranelagh, opened 1742, was a different kind of room. Outdoors, mixed sex, paid by the entrance, organized around walks, concerts, fireworks, and tea served in small porcelain cups. Tea was the polite drink, the morning and afternoon drink, the drink that did not exclude women from the social space the way the coffee house did. The tea garden was where the 18th century urban middle class, the merchants' wives, the apprentices' families, found their own kind of room. The country gentry visiting town staged a particular form of public respectability. The architecture was deliberately pastoral, the entrance fee deliberately exclusionary enough to keep the space middle class, the rituals around the cup deliberately delicate. None of this was Chinese tea practice. It was an English construction around an imported Chinese drink. The chocolate house was the smallest of the 3 categories, but the most explicitly aristocratic. White's, founded in 1693 on St. James's Street, began as a chocolate house catering to high society men and eventually became the private members' club it remains today. The Cocoa Tree on Pall Mall became the gathering place for the Tory political faction. The Spanish court version of the drink was thick, hot, mixed with cinnamon and almonds and vanilla, as well as sugar, and served in elaborate silver pots. Chocolate houses imported some of that aesthetic. The drink was significantly more expensive per cup than coffee, which is part of why the room was more exclusive. Each drink summoned a different room. Each room reproduced the social position of the drink. None of these public forums was modeled on the originating culture's practice. The London coffee house owed more to the Ottoman Kaveh Khane than to anything specifically European. But it added the printed newspaper, the joint stock company meeting, and the political pamphlet. The English tea garden was the polite sociability inverse of the Japanese chanoyu. The same drink, an entirely different choreography. The chocolate house took the Mexica court drink, sweetened it, served it in silver, and used it to mark European aristocratic membership. The room was always a European construction on top of a non-European drink. and the rune was where the social work of the 17th and 18th centuries happened.
The bond with sugar.
None of the three drinks was originally drunk sweet. Ottoman coffee was traditionally taken bitter, or with cardamom. Chinese tea was taken bitter or with savory accompaniments. Mesoamerican cacao was taken bitter, sometimes with chile or maize. What changed in Europe, and what made these three drinks spreadable across class lines rather than confined to courts and merchants, was the pairing with sugar. Sugar before about 1500 had been a Mediterranean luxury, the kind of thing kept in monastery cupboards and weighed out in grains. After 1500, sugar was the engine of the Atlantic plantation economy. Portuguese sugar plantations on Madeira from 1419, then São Tomé from the 1490s, then Brazil from the 1530s, then the English and French Caribbean from the mid-17th century, drove the price of sugar in European markets steadily down across the 17th and 18th centuries. By 1750, sugar was no longer a court product. By 1850, it was a working-class staple. The sweetening of coffee, tea, and chocolate is the practical hinge on which their European mass adoption turned. A bitter alkaloid drink is a learned taste. A bitter alkaloid drink with 2 spoonfuls of cane sugar dissolved into it is not. It is immediately palatable to a person who has never tasted it before. Sugar made coffee and tea cheap tasting in the literal sense, tasty enough to demand, easily, repeatedly, by people across the income distribution. The British working-class cup of strong tea with milk and sugar, which became the national fuel of the industrial 19th century, is the mature form of this pairing. The 18th century French aristocrat's cup of sweetened hot chocolate is the elite form. The same chemistry, sugar dissolving bitterness into a calorie and stimulant drink, is doing the work in both. What that pairing rests on is the labor system that made sugar cheap. The Atlantic plantation economy that drove down sugar prices was inseparable from the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans. Roughly 12.5 million Africans were forcibly transported across the Atlantic between the early 16th and the mid-19th centuries. The cup of sweet tea on a London table in 1780, and the cup of sweet coffee on a Parisian table the same evening, and the cup of hot chocolate on a Madrid breakfast tray the next morning, was, in commercial terms, a product whose affordability was set by the cheapness of enslaved labor in places the consumer would never see. The full version of that history is in Sugar and Slavery, the sweet tooth with a cost most people have forgotten, and it is the essential paired reading for this article. The bitter drink story cannot be told honestly without it. This is the part of the European cafe's history that most cafe romanticization leaves out. The coffee house on Cornhill, the chocolate house on St. James's, the tea garden at Vauxhall, they were rooms that worked economically because the bitterness in the cup was bridged by a sugar produced on islands whose plantation labor system was forced. The room is not erased by naming this. The room becomes legible. The colonial trade architecture, 3 drinks, 3 colonial systems. The architectures were different in detail, and naming each accurately matters. Coffee, until about 1700, was an Ottoman Yemeni monopoly. The highlands above the port of Mocha grew almost all the coffee that reached Europe, and the Ottoman state and its Yemeni clients controlled the export. In 1690, the Dutch East India Company smuggled live seedlings out of Yemen and planted them on Java, breaking the monopoly and opening colonial coffee cultivation in the East Indies. The French followed with plantations on Bourbon, now Reunion, and Saint-Domingue, now Haiti. The Portuguese with Brazilian plantations from the 1720s that would eventually become the world's largest. The Caribbean and Brazilian coffee plantations used the same labor architecture as the sugar plantations, enslaved African labor. And the cup price in Europe collapsed across the 18th century. By 1800, coffee was reaching working-class households across European cities. The cost of that accessibility was paid by the people forced to work the plantations, in which Britain forced China at gunpoint to open its ports to opium and to cede Hong Kong. The 18th and 19th century British cup of sweet tea was, in trade terms, the downstream product of opium smuggling, naval warfare, and forced concessions. The same period saw the British begin tea cultivation in Assam from the 1830s and Ceylon from the 1860s, using indentured South Indian Tamil labor on conditions historians have generally classified as a form of unfree labor. Cacao was carried by Spanish colonial extraction in Mesoamerica from the 1520s. The encomienda system, then the repartimiento labor draft, then later African enslaved labor on cacao plantations in coastal Venezuela and Ecuador, produced the cacao that reached European chocolate houses. As demand expanded, the Portuguese added plantations on Brazil's Bahia coast, and by the late 19th century, on the West African islands of São Tomé and Príncipe, where labor conditions documented by William Cadbury's own auditors in 1909 led to a brief British chocolate firm boycott of São Tomé cacao. Modern West African cacao cultivation, Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana, now produce more than 60% of the world's cacao, descends from that late 19th century Portuguese expansion, with 20th century French and British colonial overlay. Documented child labor and forced labor in modern Ivorian and Ghanaian cacao supply chains is the unresolved tale of that history. The structure of the question is not historical. This is the part of the cooking system reading that most cafe histories skip. The parallel three-track colonial architecture that put coffee, tea, and chocolate within reach of European cities. The architecture was real, the violence was specific, and naming it is not optional. The older spice trade precedent, the way pepper, cinnamon, and clove built the Portuguese, Dutch, and British East India trade systems before coffee and tea did, is documented in Pepper and Empire. The coffee, tea, chocolate trade is, structurally, the second generation of that same system, applied to a different category of commodity. Bitter as class marker, sugar as bridge. By the second half of the 18th century, all three drinks had crossed into general European consumption, but each carried a class signature. The signature was not in the drink itself. It was in the room, the vessel, and the company. Tea in Britain did a particularly clean class crossover. Through the early 18th century, it was an aristocratic drink, served from porcelain teapots in drawing rooms. By the late 18th century, with EIC volumes increasing and per pound prices falling, it had reached the middle class. By the mid-19th century, with the consolidation of the working class urban diet around tea with sugar, it had reached the factory workers' table. The cup was a different cup at each level, bone china in the drawing room, thick earthenware on the factory bench, but the drink was the same. The Victorian afternoon tea ritual is the aristocratic codification of a habit by then universal. Coffee crossed differently. Espresso, developed in northern Italy in the early 20th century, accelerated coffee into a 30-second drink, which made it possible to sell to working-class commuters on the way to a shift. Northern European filter coffee, brewed slowly and consumed over an hour, settled into a different kind of room. Same bean, different speed of consumption, different social form. Chocolate never quite made the class crossover that coffee and tea did, in part because cacao required more processing and more sugar to make palatable, and in part because the European chocolate trade did not commoditize as fully as coffee and tea until the 19th century technical innovations. Conrad van Houten's defatting press, 1828. J.S. Fry's first molded chocolate bar, 1847. Daniel Peter's milk chocolate, 1875. Rodolphe Lindt's conching, 1879. Turned chocolate from a drink into a confection. By 1900, chocolate had become a children's product and a women's gift, sold as a bar and a box, rather than a cup. The drinking form survived in Spanish-language cultures, in Italian cioccolata densa, and in late-night Parisian chocolat chaud. In most of Northern Europe and North America, chocolate stopped meaning a drink by the early 20th century. Across all three drinks, bitterness was the medium and sugar was the bridge. Each drink in its more bitter form signaled a more rarefied membership. Court chocolate, ceremonial matcha, espresso ristretto. Each drink, in its more sweetened form, reached further down the income distribution. The class architecture of bitterness was simultaneously a class architecture of sugar dose, and that sugar dose came from the plantation economies named in the previous section. The class crossover and the colonial labor system were not parallel histories, they were the same history. What stayed and what changed? 300 years after Pascoal Rosé's shed, what survives and what does not is worth reading carefully. Each of the three drinks took a different shape into modernity. The coffee house survived more or less intact. The modern cafe, Italian, French, Viennese, the Anglophone Starbucks descendant, is recognizably the institution Rosé and his successors built. The newspaper has shifted to the laptop screen. The espresso machine has replaced the sesve. But the core form, a public room, a counter that sells a hot caffeinated drink, tables for sitting and talking, is continuous from 1652. Edward Lloyd's Coffee House is still trading insurance 4 centuries later under the same name. The room turned out to be one of European modernity's more durable inventions. The British afternoon tea is intact in its codified form, although it is now more often a hotel ritual than a domestic one. Stronger continuity is in the working-class cup of tea. Strong black tea brewed in a pot or a mug, with milk and sugar, is still Britain's per capita most consumed hot drink. The same cup is now also in Pakistani, Indian, and Sri Lankan diasporic households in the same cities, where it operates on the original Asian tea practice with a British 19th century overlay. Drinking chocolate is the one form that mostly disappeared from Northern European and North American daily life. The bitter Mesoamerican cup was sweetened by the Spanish in the 16th century, became a Spanish court ritual through the 17th, spread to the European aristocracy through the 18th, then was displaced by the chocolate bar from the mid-19th century onwards. The closer to original form, water-based, much darker, sometimes with chili or cinnamon, survives in the modern Mexican chocolate de mesa tradition. The lineage from drink to confection runs through to recipes like chocolate mousse, a structural cousin of the whipped chocolate court drink. Matcha traveled a parallel path, the Japanese ceremonial form, whisked from stone-ground green leaf into hot water, survives in Japan and now in modern global cafe culture. Often as an iced matcha latte or iced cafe latte, where it shares a glass with the milk and sugar reflex inherited from the British tea tradition. What also persisted is the trade infrastructure. The colonial plantation economies that delivered coffee, tea, and cacao to European cities did not end when colonies became independent. Modern coffee, tea, and cacao supply chains are descendant systems of the same architecture. Brazilian and Vietnamese coffee, Kenyan and Sri Lankan and Indian tea, Ivorian and Ghanaian cacao, operating in formerly post-colonial economies, but with the same north-south transfer structure the 17th century trade installed. Fair trade certification and direct trade systems exist as partial correctives. Documented child labor and forced labor in West African cacao chains exists as evidence the correctives are incomplete. The structure of the question, who pays for what we no longer pay for, is the same one sugar and slavery closes on. The coffee, tea, chocolate story is a long second chorus of that question. A cookable closing. In a modern kitchen, the three drinks are easier to make than at any point in their history. An espresso machine on a counter produces what the rosé shed needed a charcoal brazier and a zesvi to produce. A small electric kettle and a tin of leaf tea, or a stone-ground matcha and a bamboo whisk, produce what Lu Yu wrote about in 760 CE. A bar of 100% Mexican chocolate de mesa, melted into hot water with cinnamon and a pinch of chile, produces something closer to the Mesoamerican original than any chocolate house ever did. The bitterness, in each case, is the original bitterness. The sugar dose is the modern cook's choice. Reading these drinks the way this article has read them, as drinks that already had thousand-year cultures of origin, that reached European cities through three different colonial systems in the same hundred-year window, that built three different public rooms around bitterness and sugar, that carried a plantation labor architecture into a sweetened cup, is the kind of reading the timeline of cooking systems is built for. The full history of bitterness as a flavor is the subject of Chapter 1 of the Atlas of Cooking Systems. The older spice trade precedent that made these three colonial systems possible is in pepper and empire. The labor architecture they ran on is in sugar and slavery. The medieval framing that prepared European medical thinking to absorb caffeine and theobromine as drug-like substances is in when spices transformed into medicine. And the sibling article in this companion series, What Happened When the Household Kitchen Began Handing Daily Food Preparation to Factories, is in convenience food and the disappearing hour. A cup of bitter coffee, a cup of properly steeped tea, a cup of bitter chocolate. Three small rooms a modern cook can reopen on a kitchen counter. The rooms outside the cup are still being negotiated.